work, but will be happy to be working on my land soon. It is nice to come home in the evening and find a letter from you. I wish you good fortune in finding a subject you would care to write a book about. Yours sincerely, Dawsey Adams.
From Amelia Morgery to Juliet. 8th of February, 1946. Dear Miss Ashton, Dawsey Adams has just been to call on me. I have never seen him as pleased with anything as he is with your gift and letter. He was so busy convincing me to write to you by the next post that he forgot to be shy. I don't believe he is aware of it, but Dawsey has a rare gift for persuasion. He never asks for anything for himself, so everyone is eager to do what he asks for others. He told me of your proposed article and asked if I would write to you about the literary society we formed during, and because of, the German occupation. I will be happy to do so, but with a caveat. A friend from England sent me a copy of Izzy Bickerstaff Goes to War. We had no news from the outside world for 5 years, so you can imagine how satisfying it was to learn how England endured those years herself. Your book was as informative as it was entertaining and amusing, but it is the amusing tone I must quibble with. I realize that our name, the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society, is an unusual one and could easily be subjected to ridicule. Would you assure me you will not be tempted to do so? The society members are very dear to me, and I do not wish them to be perceived as objects of fun by your readers. Would you be willing to tell me of your intentions for the article and also something of yourself? If you can appreciate the import of my questions, I should be glad to tell you about the society. I hope I shall hear from you soon. Yours sincerely, Amelia Morgery.
From Juliet to Amelia, 10th of February, 1946. Mrs. Amelia Morgery, Windcross Manor, Le Bouvet, St. Martin's, Guernsey. Dear Mrs. Morgery, thank you for your letter. I am very glad to answer your questions. I did make fun of many wartime situations. The Spectator felt a light approach to the bad news would serve as an antidote and that humour would help to raise London's low morale. I am very glad Izzy served that purpose, but the need to be humorous against the odds is, thank goodness, over. I would never make fun of anyone who loved to read, nor of Mr. Adams. I was glad to learn one of my books fell into such hands as his. Since you should know something about me, I have asked the Reverend Simon Simplice of St. Hilda's Church near Bury St. Edmunds, Suffolk, to write to you. He has known me since I was a child and is fond of me. I have asked Lady Bella Taunton to provide a reference for me too. We were fire wardens together during the Blitz, and she wholeheartedly dislikes me. Between the two of them, you may get a fair picture of my character. I am enclosing a copy of a biography I wrote about Anne Bronte, so you can see that I am capable of a different kind of work. It didn't sell very well. In fact, not at all. But I am much prouder of it than I am of Izzy Bickerstaff Goes to War. If there is anything else I can do to assure you of my goodwill, I will be glad to do so. Yours sincerely, Juliet Ashton. From Juliet to Sophie, 12th of February, 1946. Dearest Sophie, Markham V. Reynolds, he of the Camellias, has finally materialized. Introduced himself, paid me compliments, and invited me out to dinner. Claridge's, no less. I accepted regally. Claridge's? Oh, yes. I have heard of Claridge's. And then spent the next 3 days fretting about my hair. It's lucky I have my lovely new dress, so I didn't have to waste precious fretting time on my clothes. As Madame Helena said, the hairs, they are a disaster. I tried a roll, it fell down. A French twist, It fell down. I was on the verge of trying an enormous red velvet bow on the top of my head when my neighbour, Evangeline Smythe, came to the rescue, bless her. She's a genius with my hair. In 2 minutes, I was a picture of elegance. She caught up all the curls and swirled them around in the back, and I could even move my head. Off I went, feeling perfectly adorable. Not even Claridge's marble lobby could intimidate me. Then Markham V. Reynolds stepped forward, and the bubble popped. He's dazzling. Honestly, Sophie, I've never seen anything like him. Not even the furnace man can compare. Tan, with blazing blue eyes, ravishing leather shoes, elegant wool suit, blinding white handkerchief in breast pocket. Of course, being American, he's tall, and he has one of those alarming American smiles, all gleaming teeth and good humour. But he's not a genial American. He's quite impressive, and he's used to ordering people about, though he does it so easily they don't notice. He's got that way of believing his opinion is the truth, but he's not disagreeable about it. He's too sure he's right to bother being disagreeable. Once we were seated in our own velvet-draped alcove, and all the waiters and stewards and maitre d'hôtel were finished fluttering about us, I asked him point-blank why he had sent me those scads of flowers without including any note. He laughed. "To make you interested. If I had written you directly, asking you to meet me, how would you have replied?" I admitted I would have declined. He raised one pointed eyebrow at me. Was it his fault if he could outwit me so easily? I was awfully insulted to be so transparent, but he just laughed at me again, and then he began to talk about the war and Victorian literature. He knows I wrote a biography of Anne Bronte, and New York and rationing, and before I knew it, I was basking in his attention, utterly charmed. Do you remember that afternoon in Leeds, when we speculated on the possible reasons why Markham V. Reynolds, Jr. was obliged to remain a man of mystery? It's very disappointing, but we were completely wrong. He's not married. He's certainly not bashful. He doesn't have a disfiguring scar that causes him to shun daylight. He doesn't seem to be a werewolf. No fur on his knuckles, anyway. And he's not a Nazi on the lam. He'd have an accent. Now that I think about it, maybe he is a werewolf. I can picture him lunging over the moors in hot pursuit of his prey, and I'm certain that he wouldn't think twice about eating an innocent bystander. I'll watch him closely at the next full moon. He's asked me to go dancing tomorrow. Perhaps I should wear a high collar. Oh, that's vampires, isn't it? I think I am a little giddy. Love, Juliet.
From Lady Bella Taunton to Amelia. 12th of February, 1946. Dear Mrs. Morgury, Juliet Ashton's letter is at hand, and I am amazed at its contents. Am I to understand she wishes me to provide a character reference for her? Well, so be it. I cannot impugn her character, only her common sense. She hasn't any. War, as you know, makes strange bedfellows, and Juliet and I were thrown together from the very first when we were fire wardens during the Blitz. Fire wardens spent their nights on various London rooftops watching out for incendiary bombs that might fall. When they did, we would rush forth with stirrup pump and buckets of sand to stifle any small blaze before it would spread. Juliet and I were paired off to work together. We did not chat as less conscientious wardens would have done. I insisted on total vigilance at all times. Even so, I learned a few details of her life prior to the war. Her father was a respectable farmer in Suffolk. Her mother, I surmise, was a typical farmer's wife, milking cows and plucking chickens, when not otherwise engaged in owning a bookshop in Bury St. Edmunds. Juliet's parents were both killed in a motor accident when she was 12, and she went to live with her great-uncle, a renowned classicist in St. John's Wood. There she disrupted his studies and household by running away. Twice. In despair, he sent her to a select boarding school. When she left school, she shunned a higher education, came to London, and shared a studio with her friend Sophie Stark. She worked by day in bookshops. By night, she wrote a book about one of those wretched Bronte girls, I forget which one. I believe the book was published by Sophie's brother's firm, Stevens and Stark. Though it's biologically impossible, I can only assume that some form of nepotism was responsible for the book's publication. In any event, she began to publish feature articles for various magazines and newspapers. Her light, frivolous turn of mind gained her a large following among the less intellectually inclined readers, of whom, I fear, there are many. She spent the very last of her inheritance on a flat in Chelsea. Chelsea, home of artists, models, libertines and socialists, completely irresponsible people all, just as Juliet proved herself to be as a fire warden. I come now to the specifics of our association. Juliet and I were two of several wardens assigned to the roof of the Inner Temple Hall of the Inns of Court. Let me say first that, for a warden, quick action and a clear head were imperative. One had to be aware of everything going on around one. Everything. One night, in May 1941, a high-explosive bomb was dropped through the roof of the Inner Temple Hall Library. The library roof was some distance away from Juliet's post, but she was so aghast by the destruction of her precious books that she sprinted toward the flames, as if she could single-handedly deliver the library from its fate. Of course, her delusions created nothing but further damage, for the fireman had to waste valuable minutes in rescuing her. I believe Juliet suffered some minor burns in the debacle, but 50,000 books were blown to kingdom come. Juliet's name was stricken from the lists of the fire wardens, and rightly so. I discovered she then volunteered her services to the auxiliary fire services. On the morning after a bombing raid, the AFS would be on hand to offer tea and comfort to the rescue squads. The AFS also provided assistance to the survivors, reuniting families, securing temporary housing, clothing, food, funds. I believe Juliet to have been adequate to that daytime task, causing no catastrophe among the teacups. She was free to occupy her nights however she chose. Doubtless it included the writing of more light journalism, for the Spectator engaged her to write a weekly column on the state of the nation in wartime, under the name of Izzy Bickerstaff. I read one of her columns and cancelled my subscription. She attacked the good taste of our dear, though dead, Queen Victoria. Doubtless you know of the huge memorial Victoria had built for her beloved consort, Prince Albert. It is the jewel in the crown of Kensington Gardens, a monument to the Queen's refined taste as well as to the departed. Juliet applauded the Ministry of Food for having ordered peas to be planted in the grounds surrounding that memorial, writing that no better scarecrow than Prince Albert existed in all of England. While I question her taste, her judgment, her misplaced priorities, and her inappropriate sense of humour, she does indeed have one fine quality. She is honest. If she says she will honour the good name of your literary society, she will do so. I can say no more. Sincerely yours, Bella Taunton.
From the Reverend Simon Simplus to Amelia, 13th of February, 1946. Dear Mrs. Morgry, yes, you may trust Juliet. I am unequivocal on this point. Her parents were my good friends as well as my parishioners at St. Hilda's. Indeed, I was a guest at their home on the night she was born. Juliet was a stubborn but, withal, a sweet, considerate, joyous child, with an unusual bent toward integrity for one so young. I will tell you of one incident when she was 10 years old. Juliet, while singing the fourth stanza of His Eye is on the Sparrow, slammed her hymnal shut and refused to sing another note. She told our choir director the lyrics cast a slur on God's character. We should not be singing it. He, the choir director, not God, didn't know what to do, so he escorted Juliet to my office for me to reason with her. I did not fare very well. Juliet said, "Well, he shouldn't have written His Eye is on the Sparrow. What good was that? Did he stop the bird from falling down dead? Did he just say, oops? It makes God sound like he's off bird-watching when real people need him." I felt compelled to agree with Juliet on this matter. Why had I never thought upon it before? The choir did not sing and has not since sung His Eye is on the Sparrow. Juliet's parents died when she was 12, and she was sent to live with her great-uncle, Dr. Roderick Ashton, in London. Though not an unkind man, he was so mired in his Greco-Roman studies, he had no time to pay the girl any attention. He had no imagination, either, fatal for one engaged in child-rearing. She ran away twice, the first time making it only as far as King's Cross Station. The police found her waiting, with a packed canvas carry-all and her father's fishing rod, to catch the train to Bury St. Edmunds. She was returned to Dr. Ashton, and she ran away again. This time Dr. Ashton telephoned me to ask for my help in finding her. I knew exactly where to go, to her parents' former farm. I found her opposite the farm's entrance, sitting on a little wooded knoll, impervious to the rain, just sitting there, soaked, looking at her old, now sold, home. I wired her uncle and went back with her on the train to London the following day. I had intended to return to my parish on the next train, but when I discovered her fool of an uncle had sent his cook to fetch her home, I insisted on accompanying them. I invaded his study, and we had a vigorous talk. He agreed a boarding school might be best for Juliet. Her parents had left ample funds for such an eventuality. Fortunately, I knew of a very good school, St. Swithin's, academically a fine school, and with a headmistress not carved from granite. I am happy to tell you Juliet thrived there. She found her studies stimulating, but I believe the true reason for Juliet's regained spirits was her friendship with Sophie Stark and the Stark family. She often went to Sophie's home for half-term vacation, and Juliet and Sophie came twice to stay with me and my sister at the rectory. What jolly times we shared! Picnics, bicycle rides, fishing. Sophie's brother, Sidney Stark, joined us once, though 10 years older than the girls, and despite an inclination to boss them around, he was a welcome fifth to our happy party. It was rewarding to watch Juliet grow up, as it is now to know her fully grown. I am very happy she asked me to write to you of her character. I have included our small history together, so you will realize I know whereof I speak. If Juliet says she will, she will. If she says she won't, she won't. Very truly yours, Simon Simplus.
Susan Scott to Juliet. 17th of February, 1946. Dear Juliet, was that possibly you I glimpsed in this week's Tatler, doing the rumba with Mark Reynolds? You looked gorgeous, almost as gorgeous as he did. But might I suggest that you move to an air raid shelter before Sydney sees a copy? You can purchase my silence with torrid details, you know. Yours, Susan.
Juliet to Susan Scott, 18th of February, 1946. Dear Susan,
I deny everything. Love, Juliet.
From Amelia to Juliet. 18th of February, 1946. Dear Miss Ashton, thank you for taking my caveat so seriously. At the society meeting last night, I told the members about your article for the Times and suggested that those who wished to do so should correspond with you about the books they read and the joy they found in reading. The response was so vociferous. Isola Pribby, our sergeant-at-arms, was forced to bang her hammer for order. I admit that Isola needs little encouragement to bang her hammer. I think you will receive a good many letters from us, and I hope they will be of some help in your article. Dorsey has told you that the society was invented as a ruse to keep the Germans from arresting my dinner guests, Dorsey, Isola, Eben Ramsey, John Booker, Will Fisby, and our dear Elizabeth McKenna, who manufactured the story on the spot. Bless her quick wits and silver tongue. I, of course, knew nothing of their predicament at the time. As soon as they left, I made haste down to my cellar to bury the evidence of our meal. The first I heard about our literary society was the next morning at 7, when Elizabeth appeared in my kitchen and asked, "How many books have you got?" I had quite a few, but Elizabeth looked at my shelves and shook her head. "We need more. There's too much gardening here." She was right, of course. I do like a good garden book. "I tell you what we'll do," she said. "After I'm done at the Commandant's office, we'll go to Fox's bookshop and buy them out. If we're going to be the Guernsey Literary Society, we have to look literary." I was frantic all forenoon, worrying over what was happening at the Commandant's office. What if they all ended up in the Guernsey jail? Or, worst of all, in a prison camp on the continent? The Germans were erratic in dispensing their justice, so one never knew which sentence would be imposed. But nothing of the sort occurred. Odd as it may sound, the Germans allowed, and even encouraged, artistic and cultural pursuits among the Channel Islanders. Their object was to prove to the British that the German occupation was a model occupation. How this message was to be conveyed to the outside world was never explained, as the telephone and telegraph cable between Guernsey and London had been cut the day the Germans landed in June 1940. Whatever their skewed reasoning, the Channel Islands were treated much more leniently than the rest of conquered Europe, at first. At the Commandant's office, my friends were ordered to pay a small fine and submit the name and membership list of their society. The Commandant announced that he too was a lover of literature. Might he, with a few like-minded officers, sometimes attend meetings? Elizabeth told them they would be most welcome. And then she, Eben, and I flew to Fox's, chose armloads of books for our newfound society, and rushed back to the manor to put them on my shelves. Then we strolled from house to house, looking as carefree and casual as we could, in order to alert the others to come that evening and choose a book to read. It was agonizing to walk slowly, stopping to chat here and there when we wanted to scurry. Timing was vital, since Elizabeth feared the Commandant would appear at the next meeting, a bare 2 weeks away. He did not. A few German officers did attend over the years, but thankfully left in some confusion and did not return. And so it was that we began. I knew all our members, but I did not know them all well. Dorsey had been my neighbour for over 30 years, and yet I don't believe I had ever spoken to him of anything more than weather and farming. Isola was a dear friend, and Eben too, but Will Thisby was only an acquaintance, and John Booker was nearly a stranger, for he had only just arrived when the Germans came. It was Elizabeth we had in common. Without her urging, I would never have thought to invite them to share my pig, and the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society would never have drawn breath. That evening, when they came to my house to make their selections, those who had rarely read anything other than scripture, seed catalogues, and the Pigman's Gazette, discovered a different kind of reading. It was here Dorsey found his Charles Lamb, and Isola fell upon Wuthering Heights. For myself, I chose the Pickwick Papers, thinking it would lift my spirits. It did. Then each went home and read. We began to meet, for the sake of the commandant at first, and then for our own pleasure. None of us had any experience with literary societies, so we made our own rules. We took turns speaking about the books we'd read. At the start, we tried to be calm and objective, but that soon fell away, and the purpose of the speakers was to goad the listeners into wanting to read the book themselves. Once two members had read the same book, they could argue, which was our great delight. We read books, talked books, argued over books, and became dearer and dearer to one another. Other islanders asked to join us, and our evenings together became bright, lively times. We could almost forget, now and then, the darkness outside. We still meet every fortnight. Will Thisby was responsible for the inclusion of potato peel pie in our society's name. Germans or no, he wasn't going to go to any meetings unless there were eats. So refreshments became part of our programme. Since there was scant butter, less flour, and no sugar to spare on Guernsey then, Will concocted a potato peel pie. Mashed potatoes for filling, strained beets for sweetness, and potato peelings for crust. Will's recipes are usually dubious, but this one became a favourite. I would enjoy hearing from you again, and learning how your article progresses. Yours most sincerely, Amelia Morgery.
From Isola Pribby to Juliet. 19th of February, 1946. Dear Miss Ashton, oh my, oh my, you have written a book about Anne Bronte, sister to Charlotte and Emily. Amelia Morgery says she will lend it to me, for she knows I have a fondness for the Bronte girls. Poor lambs. To think all five of them had weak chests and died so young. What a sadness. Their pa was a selfish thing, wasn't he? He paid his girls no mind at all, always sitting in his study yelling for his shawl. He never rose up to wait on hisself, did he? Just sat alone in his room while his daughters died like flies. And their brother Branwell, he wasn't much either. Always drinking and sicking up on the carpets. They were forever having to clean up after him. Fine work for lady authoresses. It is my belief that with two such men in the household and no way to meet others, Emily had to make Heathcliff up, out of thin air. And what a fine job she did. Men are more interesting in books than they are in real life. Amelia told us you would like to know about our book society and what we talk about at our meetings. I gave a talk on the Bronte girls once when it was my turn to speak. I'm sorry I can't send you my notes on Charlotte and Emily. I used them to kindle a fire in my cook stove, there being no other paper in the house. I'd already burnt up my tide tables, the Book of Revelation, and the story about Job. You will want to know why I admired those girls. I like stories of passionate encounters. I myself have never had one, but now I can picture one. I didn't like Wuthering Heights at first, but the minute that spectre, Cathy, scrabbled her bony fingers on the window glass, I was grasped by the throat and not let go. With that, Emily, I could hear Heathcliff's pitiful cries upon the moors. I don't believe that after reading such a fine writer as Emily Bronte, I would be happy to read again Miss Amanda Gillyflower's Ill-Used by Candlelight. Reading good books ruins you for enjoying bad books. I will tell you now about myself. I have a cottage and small holding next to Amelia Morgery's manor house and farm. We are both situated by the sea. I tend my chickens and my goat, Ariel, and grow things. I have a parrot in my keeping, too. Her name is Zenobia, and she does not like men. I have a stall at market every week where I sell my preserves, vegetables, and elixirs I make to restore manly ardour. Kit McKenna, daughter to my dear friend Elizabeth McKenna, helps me make my potions. She is only 4, and has to stand on a stool to stir my pot, but she is able to whip up big froths. I do not have a pleasing appearance. My nose is big, and was broken when I fell off the henhouse roof. One eyeball skitters up to the top, and my hair is wild and will not stay tamped down. I am tall and built of big bones. I could write to you again if you want me to. I could tell you more about reading and how it perked up our spirits while the Germans were here. The only time reading didn't help was after Elizabeth was arrested by the Germans. They caught her hiding one of those poor slave workers from Poland, and they sent her to prison in France. There was no book that could lift my heart then, nor for a long time after. It was all I could do not to slap every German I saw. For Kit's sake, I held myself in. She was only a little sprout then, and she needed us. Elizabeth hasn't come home yet. We are afraid for her. But mind you, I say it's early days yet, and she might still come home. I pray so, for I miss her sorely. Your friend, Isola Pribby.
From Juliet to Dorsey, 20th of February, 1946. Dear Mr. Adams, how did you know that I like white lilacs above all flowers? I always have, and now here they are, pluming out over my desk. They are beautiful, and I love having them. The look, the delicious scent, and the surprise of them. At first I thought, how on earth did he find these in February? And then I remembered that the Channel Islands are blessed by a warm Gulf Stream. Mr. Dilwyn appeared at my door with your present early this morning. He said he was in London on business for his bank. He assured me it was no trouble at all to deliver the flowers. There wasn't much he wouldn't do for you because of some soap you gave Mrs. Dilwyn during the war. She still cries every time she thinks of it. What a nice man he is. I am sorry he didn't have time to stop for coffee. Due to your kind offices, I have received lovely long letters from Mrs. Morgery and Isola Pribby. I hadn't realized that the Germans permitted no outside news at all, not even letters, to reach Guernsey. It surprised me so much. It shouldn't have. I knew the Channel Islands had been occupied, but I never, not once, thought what that might have entailed. Willful ignorance is all I can call it. So I am off to the London Library to educate myself. The library suffered terrible bomb damage, but the floors are safe to walk on again. All the books that could be saved are back on the shelf, and I know they have collected all the times from 1900 to yesterday. I shall study up on the occupation. I want to find some travel or history books about the Channel Islands too. Is it really true that on a clear day you can see the cars on the French coast roads? So it says in my encyclopedia, but I bought it second-hand for 4 shillings, and I don't trust it. There I also learned that Guernsey is roughly 7 miles long and 5 miles wide, with a population of 42,000 inhabitants. Strictly speaking, very informative, but I want to know more than that. Miss Pribby told me that your friend, Elizabeth McKenna, had been sent to a prison camp on the continent and has not yet returned. It knocked the wind out of me. Ever since your letter about the roast pig dinner, I had been imagining her there among you. Without even knowing I was doing so, I depended upon one day receiving a letter from her too. I am sorry. I will hope for her early return. Thank you again for my flowers. It was a lovely thing for you to do. Yours ever, Juliet Ashton. P.S. You may consider this a rhetorical question if you want to, but why did Mrs. Dilwyn weep over a cake of soap? From Juliet to Sydney, 21st of February, 1946. Dearest Sydney, I haven't heard from you in ages. Does your icy silence have anything to do with Mark Reynolds? I have an idea for a new book. It's a novel about a beautiful yet sensitive author whose spirit is crushed by her domineering editor. Do you like it? Love always, Juliet. From Juliet to Sydney, 23rd of February, 1946. Dear Sydney, I was only joking. Love, Juliet. From Juliet to Sydney, 25th of February, 1946. Sydney. Love, Juliet. From Juliet to Sydney, 26th of February, 1946. Dear Sydney, did you think I wouldn't notice you were gone? I did. After three notes went unanswered, I made a personal visit to St. James's Place, where I encountered the cast-iron Miss Tilly, who said you were out of town. Very enlightening. Upon pressing, I learned you had gone to Australia. Miss Tilly listened coolly to my exclamations. She would not disclose your exact whereabouts. Only that you were scouring the outback, seeking new authors for Stevens and Stark's list. She would forward any letters to you, at her discretion. Your Miss Tilly does not fool me. Nor do you. I know exactly where you are and what you are doing. You flew to Australia to find Piers Langley and are holding his hand while he sobers up. At least, I hope that's what you are doing. He is such a dear friend and such a brilliant writer. I want him to be well again and writing poetry. I'd add forgetting all about Burma and the Japanese, but I know that's not possible. You could have told me, you know. I can be discreet when I really try. You've never forgiven me for that slip about Mrs. Atwater and the pergola, have you? I apologised handsomely at the time. I liked your other secretary better, and you sacked her for naught, you know. Markham Reynolds and I have met. All right, we've done more than meet. We've danced the rumba. But don't fuss. He has not mentioned view, except in passing, and he hasn't once tried to lure me to New York. We talk of higher matters, such as Victorian literature. He's not the shallow dilettante you would have me believe, Sydney. He's an expert on Wilkie Collins, of all things. Did you know that Wilkie Collins maintained two separate households with two separate mistresses and two separate sets of children? The scheduling difficulties must have been shocking. No wonder he took laudanum. I do think you would like Mark if you knew him better, and you may have to. But my heart and my writing hand belong to Stevens and Stark. The article for The Times has turned into a lovely treat for me, now and ongoing. I have made a group of new friends from the Channel Islands, the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society. Don't you adore their name? If Piers needs distracting, I'll write you a nice fat letter about how they came by their name. If not, I'll tell you when you come home. When are you coming home? My neighbour, Evangeline Smythe, is going to have twins in June. She is none too happy about it. So I'm going to ask her to give one of them to me. Love to you and Piers, Juliet. From Juliet to Sophie, 28th of February, 1946. Dearest Sophie, I am as surprised as you are. He didn't breathe a word to me. On Tuesday, I realised I hadn't heard from Sydney in days, so I went to Stevens and Stark to demand attention and found he'd flown the coop. that new secretary of his is a fiend. To every one of my questions, she said, I really can't divulge information of a personal nature, Miss Ashton. How I wanted to smack her. Just as I was concluding that Sydney had been tapped by MI6 and was on a mission in Siberia, horrible Miss Tilly admitted that he'd gone to Australia. Well, it all came clear then, didn't it? He's gone to get Piers. Teddy Lucas seemed quite certain that Piers was going to drink himself steadily to death in that rest home unless someone came and stopped him. I can hardly blame him after what he's been through. But Sydney won't allow it, thank God. You know I adore Sydney with all my heart, but there's something terrifically liberating about Sydney in Australia. Mark Reynolds has been what your Aunt Lydia would have called persistent in his attentions for the last 3 weeks, but even as I've gobbled lobster and guzzled champagne, I've been looking furtively over my shoulder for Sydney. He's convinced that Mark is trying to steal me away from London in general, and Stevens and Stark in particular, and nothing I said could persuade him otherwise. I know he doesn't like Mark. I believe aggressive and unscrupulous were the words he used last time I saw him. But really, he was a bit too King Lear about the whole thing. I am a grown woman, mostly, and I can guzzle champagne with whomever I choose. When not checking under tablecloths for Sydney, I've been having the most wonderful time. I feel as though I've emerged from a black tunnel and found myself in the middle of a carnival. I don't particularly care for carnivals, but after the tunnel, it's delicious. Mark gads about every night. If we're not going to a party, and we usually are, we're off to the cinema, or the theatre, or a nightclub, or a gin house of ill repute. He says he's trying to introduce me to democratic ideals. It's very exciting. Have you noticed there are some people, Americans especially, who seem untouched by the war, or at least unmangled by it? I don't mean to imply that Mark was a shirker, he was in their air corps, but he's simply not sunk under it. And when I'm with him, I feel untouched by the war too. It's an illusion, I know it is, and truthfully, I'd be ashamed of myself if the war hadn't touched me. But it's forgivable to enjoy myself a little, isn't it? Is Dominic too old for a jack-in-the-box? I saw a diabolical one in a shop yesterday. It pops out, leering and weaving, its oily black moustache curling above pointed white teeth. The very picture of a villain. Dominic would adore it, after he had got over his first shock. Love, Juliet. From Juliet to Isola, 28th of February, 1946. Miss Isola Pribby, Pribby Homestead, La Bouvet, St. Martin's, Guernsey. Dear Miss Pribby, thank you so much for your letter about yourself and Emily Bronte. I laughed when I read that Emily had caught you by the throat the second poor Cathy's ghost knocked at the window. She got me at the exact same moment. Our teacher had assigned Wuthering Heights to be read over the Easter holiday. I went home with my friend Sophie Stark, and we whined for 2 days over the injustice of it all. Finally, her brother, Sydney, told us to shut up and get on with it. I did, still fuming, until I got to Cathy's ghost at the window. I have never felt such dread as I did then. Monsters or vampires have never scared me in books, but ghosts are a different matter. Sophie and I did nothing the rest of our holiday but move from bed to hammock to armchair, reading Jane Eyre, Agnes Grey, Shirley, and The Tenant of Wildfell Hall. What a family they were. But I chose to write about Anne Bronte because she was the least known of the sisters, and, I think, just as fine a writer as Charlotte. Lord knows how Anne managed to write any books at all, influenced by such a strain of religion as her Aunt Branwell possessed. Emily and Charlotte had the good sense to ignore their bleak aunt, but not poor Anne. Imagine preaching that God meant women to be meek, mild and gently melancholic. So much less trouble around the house. Pernicious old bat. I hope you will write to me again. Yours, Juliet Ashton.
From Eben Ramsey to Juliet. 28th of February, 1946. Dear Miss Ashton, I am a Guernsey man and my name is Eben Ramsey. My fathers before me were tombstone cutters and carvers, lambs a specialty. These are the things I like to do of an evening, but for my livelihood, I fish. Mrs. Margery said you would like to have letters about our reading during the occupation. I was never going to talk, or think, if I could help it, about those days, but Mrs. Margery said we could trust to your judgment in writing about the society during the war. If Mrs. Margery says you could be trusted, I believe it. Also, you had such kindness to send my friend Dawsey a book, and he all but unknown to you. So I am writing to you and hope it will be a help to your story. Best to say we weren't a true literary society at first. Aside from Elizabeth, Mrs. Margery, and perhaps Booker, most of us hadn't had much to do with books since our school years. We took them from Mrs. Margery's shelves, fearful we'd spoil the fine papers. I had no zest for such matters in those days. It was only by fixing my mind on the commandant and jail that I could make myself to lift up the cover of the book and begin. It was called Selections from Shakespeare. Later I came to see that Mr. Dickens and Mr. Wordsworth were thinking of men like me when they wrote their words. But most of all, I believe that William Shakespeare was. Mind you, I cannot always make sense of what he says, but it will come. It seems to me the less he said, the more beauty he made. Do you know what sentence of his I admire the most? It is, "The bright day is done, and we are for the dark." I wish I'd known those words on the day I watched those German troops land, planeload after planeload of them, and come off ships down in the harbor. All I could think of was, damn them, over and over. If I could have thought the words, "The bright day is done, and we are for the dark," I'd have been consoled somehow, and ready to go out and contend with circumstance, instead of my heart sinking to my shoes. They came here on Sunday, the 30th of June, 1940, after bombing us 2 days before. They said they hadn't meant to bomb us. They mistook our tomato lorries on the pier for army trucks. How they came to think that, strange the mind. They bombed us, killing some 30 men, women, and children. One among them was my cousin's boy. He had sheltered underneath his lorry when he first saw the planes dropping bombs, and it exploded and caught fire. They killed men in their lifeboats at sea. They strafed the Red Cross ambulances carrying our wounded. When no one shot back at them, they saw the British had left us undefended. They just flew in peaceably 2 days later and occupied us for 5 years. At first, they were as nice as could be. They were that full of themselves for conquering a bit of England, and they were thick enough to think it would just be a hop and a skip till they landed in London. When they found out that wasn't to be, they turned back to their natural meanness. They had rules for everything. Do this, don't do that. But they kept changing their minds, trying to seem friendly, like they were poking a carrot in front of a donkey's nose. But we weren't donkeys. So they'd get harsh again. For instance, they were always changing curfew. 8 at night, or 9, or 5 in the evening if they felt really mean-minded. You couldn't visit your friends or even tend your stock. We started out hopeful, sure they'd be gone in 6 months. But it stretched on and on. Food grew hard to come by, and soon there was no firewood left. Days were grey with hard work, and evenings were black with boredom. Everyone was sickly from so little nourishment, and bleak from wondering if it would ever end. We clung to books, and to our friends. They reminded us that we had another part to us. Elizabeth used to say a poem. I don't remember all of it, but it began. Is it so small a thing to have enjoyed the sun, to have lived light in the spring, to have loved, to have thought, to have done, to have advanced, true friends? It isn't. I hope, wherever she has that in her mind. Late in 1944, it didn't matter what time the Germans set the curfew for. Most people went to bed around 5 o'clock anyway to keep warm. We were rationed to 2 candles a week, and then only one. It was mighty tedious, laying up in bed with no light to read by. After D-Day, the Germans couldn't send any supply ships from France because of the Allied bombers, so they were finally as hungry as we were, and killing dogs and cats to give themselves something to eat. They would raid our gardens, rooting up potatoes, even eating the black, rotten ones. 4 soldiers died eating handfuls of hemlock, thinking it was parsley. The German officers said any soldier caught stealing food from our gardens would be shot. One poor soldier was caught stealing a potato. He was chased by his own people and climbed up a tree to hide, but they found him and shot him down out of the tree. Still, that did not stop them from stealing food. I am not pointing a finger at those practices, because some of us were doing the same. I figure hunger makes you desperate when you wake to it every morning. My grandson Eli was evacuated to England when he was 7. He is home now, 12 years old and tall. But I will never forgive the Germans for making me miss his growing up years. I must go milk my cow now, but I will write to you again, if you like. My wishes for your health, Eben Ramsey.
From Miss Adelaide Addison to Juliet. 1st of March, 1946. Dear Miss Ashton, forgive the presumption of a letter from a person unknown to you, but a clear duty is imposed upon me. I understand from Dorsey Adams that you are to write a long article for the Times Literary Supplement on the value of reading, and you intend to feature the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society therein. I laugh. Perhaps you will reconsider when you learn that their founder, Elizabeth McKenna, is not even an islander. Despite her fine airs, she is merely a jumped-up servant from the London home of Sir Ambrose Ivers, R.A., Royal Academy. Surely you know of him. He is a portrait painter of some note, though I've never understood why. His portrait of the Countess of Lambeth as Boadicea lashing her horses was unforgivable. In any event, Elizabeth McKenna was the daughter of his housekeeper, if you please. While Elizabeth's mother dusted, Sir Ambrose let the child putter in his studio, and he kept her in school long after the normal leaving time for one of her station. Her mother died when Elizabeth was 14. Did Sir Ambrose send her to an institution to be properly trained for a suitable occupation? He did not. He kept her with him in his home in Chelsea. He proposed her for a scholarship to the Slade School of Fine Art. Mind you, I do not say Sir Ambrose sired the girl. We know his proclivities too well to admit of that. But he doted upon her in a way that encouraged her besetting sin, lack of humility. The decay of standards is the cross of our times, and nowhere is this regrettable decline more apparent than in Elizabeth McKenna. Sir Ambrose owned a home in Guernsey, on the clifftops near La Bouvet. He, his housekeeper, and the girl summered here when she was a child. Elizabeth was a wild thing, roaming unkempt about the island, even on Sundays. No household chores, no gloves, no shoes, no stockings. Going out on fishing boats with rude men, spying on decent people through her telescope. A disgrace. When it became clear that the war was going to start in earnest, Sir Ambrose sent Elizabeth to close up his house. Elizabeth bore the brunt of his haphazard ways in this case, for, in the midst of putting up the shutters, the German army landed on her doorstep. However, the choice to remain here was hers, and, as is proven by certain subsequent events, which I will not demean myself to mention, she is not the selfless heroine that some people seem to think. Furthermore, the so-called Literary Society is a scandal. There are those of true culture and breeding here in Guernsey, and they will take no part in this charade, even if invited. There are only two respectable people in the society, Eben Ramsay and Amelia Morgery. The other members, a rag-and-bone man, a lapsed alienist who drinks, a stuttering swineherd, a footman posing as a lord, and Isola Pribby, a practising witch, who, by her own admission to me, distills and sells potions. They collected a few others of their ilk along the way, and one can only imagine their literary evenings. You must not write about these people and their books. God knows what they saw fit to read. Yours in Christian consternation and concern, Adelaide Addison, Miss.
From Mark to Juliet, March 2nd, 1946. Dear Juliet, I've just appropriated my music critic's opera tickets. Covent Garden at 8 o'clock? Will you? Yours, Mark.
From Juliet to Mark. Dear Mark, tonight, Juliet.
From Mark to Juliet. Yes, M.
From Juliet to Mark. Wonderful. I feel sorry for your critic, though. Those tickets are as scarce as hen's teeth. Juliet.
From Mark to Juliet. He'll make do with standing room. He can write about the uplifting effect of opera on the poor, etc., etc. I'll pick you up at 7. M.
From Juliet to Eben. 3rd of March, 1946. Mr. Eben Ramsay, Le Pommier, Calais Lane, St. Martin's, Guernsey. Dear Mr. Ramsay, it was so kind of you to write to me about your experiences during the occupation. At the war's end, I too promised myself that I had done with talking about it. I had talked and lived war for 6 years, and I was longing to pay attention to something, anything else. But that is like wishing I were someone else. The war is now the story of our lives, and there's no subtracting it. I was glad to hear about your grandson, Eli, returning to you. Does he live with you or with his parents? Did you receive no news of him at all during the occupation? Did all the Guernsey children return at once? What a celebration if they did! I don't mean to inundate you with questions, but I have a few more, if you're in an answering frame of mind. I know you were at the roast pig dinner that led to the founding of the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society, but how did Mrs. Morgery come to have the pig in the first place? How does one hide a pig? Elizabeth McKenna was brave that night. She truly has grace under pressure, a quality that fills me with hopeless admiration. I know you and the other members of the society must worry as the months pass without word, but you mustn't give up hope. Friends tell me that Europe is like a hive broken open, teeming with thousands upon thousands of displaced people, all trying to get home. A dear old friend of mine, who was shot down in Burma in 1943, reappeared in Australia last month. Not in the best of shape, but alive, and intending to remain so. Thank you for your letter. Yours sincerely, Juliet Ashton.
From Clovis Fossey to Juliet. 4th of March, 1946. Dear Miss, at first, I did not want to go to any book meetings. My farm is a lot of work, and I did not want to spend my time reading about people who never was, doing things they never did. Then in 1942, I started to court the widow Hubert. When we'd go for a walk, she'd march a few steps ahead of me on the path and never let me take her arm. She let Ralph Murchie take her arm, so I knew I was failing in my suit. Ralph, he's a bragger when he drinks, and he said to all in the tavern, women like poetry. A soft word in their ears, and they melt, a grease spot on the grass. That's no way to talk about a lady, and I knew right then He didn't want the Widow Hubert for her own self the way I did. He wanted only her grazing land for his cows. So I thought, if it rhymes the Widow Hubert wants, I will find me some. I went to see Mr. Fox in